Chapter 12. Rehabilitating America's Flawed Democracy. A Framework for Ending Vote Buying. A flawed democracy, popular trust in government, elected representatives, and political parties has fallen to extremely low levels in the U.S. The U.S. now keeps company with countries that include Italy, Botswana, Sri Lanka, and Mexico. Economist Intelligence Unit, January 2017. Electioneering spending limits serve an important complement to corruption-reducing contribution limits. When campaign costs are so high that only the rich have the reach to throw their hats into the ring, we fail to protect the political process from undue influence of large aggregations of capital and to promote individual responsibility for democratic government. Justice John Paul Stevens, Randall v. Sorrell, 2006, including quote from the Supreme Court ruling in Automobile Workers 352 U.S. at 590. Reforms can draw on the experience of Canada and Great Britain, both of which impose strict limits on money in campaigns, yet have robust elections in which there is no appreciable censorship. Richard Hassan. The income bias is compelling evidence that American democracy is of low quality. Voters are neither equal nor sovereign. The remedy is to recriminalize vote buying with limits on both donations and independent political spending. Following the example of other wealthy democracies, limits are also warranted on issue advocacy during election periods. Caps or bans in other wealthy democracies strengthen political competition, political equality, and voter sovereignty while eliminating most negative appeals. Their candidates, as exemplified by German Chancellor Angela Merkel, are eager to co-opt popular policy positions from any source, thereby edging politics to the center. Washington Post columnist Ruth Marcus explains, "In Merkel's Germany, it has resulted in a race to the middle, not just in forming a coalition government, but in the campaign itself." The most compelling lawyerly rationale in America for recriminalizing campaign donations and independent political spending is to honor original intent, as discussed in the previous chapter. Definitional precision is paramount, and when a future Supreme Court seeks to end the Buckley era, it should recall what Justice Sandra Day O'Connor concluded in McConnell v. FEC 2003. "Defining and identifying corruption is so fraught," she wrote, "that the best means of prevention is to identify and to remove the temptation." The O'Connor maxim, a sweeping, encompassing definition to remove the temptation, translates to an electoral system that permits only de minimis campaign donations and does not permit expansive political issue advertising or donations by nominal or genuinely independent entities. Any weaker standard invites inventive evasion. Drawing on experience in Denmark, France, Latvia, and Lithuania, for instance, the UK Committee on Standards in Public Life noted in 2011 that vote buyers stridently endeavor to bypass limits using loans, by divvying up donations among family members and trusted colleagues, by funneling gifts through nominally independent entities, and by creating new political parties. The O'Connor maxim would provide a clarity that's common in other wealthy nations, as noted by Professor Andrea Remmel of Berlin's Hertie School of Government. In Germany, giving money in politics is always seen as trying to buy access. Within an overarching commitment to recriminalize vote buying, America can raise the quality of its democracy with the following agenda of rules, procedures, and practices drawn from superior democracies. Limit electioneering spending. Electioneering spending caps are imposed abroad to preclude a significant role for private capital in any guise in political campaigns. In Canada, as noted earlier, electioneering outlays by major parties at the federal level were capped in 2015 at about $43 million apiece in a nation of 26 million registered voters. There and elsewhere, limits are typically imposed on a per-registered voter basis and vary with the scope of office sought. A common companion component is prohibitions or limits on broadcast advertising. With the bulk of electioneering spending devoted to inexpensive marketing options like billboards, get out the vote, and more recently, social media messaging. Limits on electioneering spending are closely monitored, audited, and rigorously enforced. For instance, the senior French court, the Constitutional Council, concluded in July 2013 that the party of presidential candidate Nicolas Sarkozy had overspent during his 2012 election contest. His overspending totaled a modest €460,000, $500,000. But the penalty was huge, a fine of €10 million, $11 million. The penalty was more than one-third of the legally allowed overall party spending, including a binary runoff in 2012, reported Financial Times journalist Hugh Carnegie. The French paper Le Figaro speculated that the penalty would be financially asphyxiating for Sarkozy's center-right UMP party for several years to come. Exactly. Ensuring that all qualified candidates have adequate electioneering resources to challenge incumbents is a key means of ensuring competitive elections. As in the U.S., debates in other wealthy democracies are vibrant. The pool of candidates is quite diverse, representing a broad range of domestic opinion. Elections are vigorously challenged, with new issues and new candidates readily emerging. Limits on spending do not quell candidate communications or voter choice. Quite the contrary, limits require a focus of scarce political communications opportunities on building candidate and party brand, while clarifying policy differences. Higher quality democracies typically provide some level of public subsidy for candidates in order to maximize political competition. Public funding, accompanied by a cap on electioneering outlays, ensures a high degree of citizen confidence in the outcome, a characteristic of what Robert Post termed electoral integrity. That does not mean equality of electioneering resources to each candidate, by the way. Instead, other wealthy democracies like Canada typically adopt systems that de facto or de jure link the actual amount of electioneering spending beneath the official ceiling to the robustness of public support, as measured by the number of small donations garnered. Limits on electioneering spending eliminate negative political advertising. Comprehensive transparency and content attribution rules in other wealthy democracies mean negative political messaging cannot be conducted anonymously. Candidates and parties risk voter blowback from attack ads. By contrast, negative advertising is common in the United States, in good part because sponsorship can be veiled, absolving political parties of accountability, especially on social media. Americans have their own considerable satisfactory experience with limits on electioneering spending. They are a central element of public campaign funding programs in a number of localities, such as Maine and New York City. The spending caps in New York City's Campaign Finance Act, CFA, enacted in 1988, are $168,000 for city council candidates and $6,426,000 for mayoral aspirants. Similar caps exist for primary elections as well. As in every other public campaign funding program in America, participation by candidates must be voluntary under prevailing Buckley-era court rulings. Tight electioneering spending limits would be popular with Americans. Some 77% of respondents in a Pew Research Center survey in late 2015 believed there should be limits on the amount of money individuals and organizations can spend on political campaigns and issues. Only 20% believed that organizations or individuals should be able to donate or spend without limit. And the sentiment was bipartisan, with 72% of Republicans and 84% of Democrats agreeing on limits. Limit donations to candidates and parties. Many higher quality democracies that limit electioneering spending, such as Belgium, Canada, France, and Japan, also choose to cap donations at modest levels. American communities that adopt public campaign funding programs have followed suit. Individual donations to New York City politicians participating in its CFA program, for instance, are capped at $2,750 for city council contests and $4,950 for mayoral races. In New York, as well as in peer nations, capping contributions to encourage numerous small donor donations serves two purposes. First, in the formative stages of an election cycle, the robustness of small donations is utilized to gauge community support for candidates, and thus eligibility to receive public subsidies. Requiring a show of small donor support is a practical market test of aspirants while winnowing marginal, ideologically extreme, or novelty candidates. To appear on ballots, aspirants typically must raise a threshold, modest amount from a predetermined number of donors. City Council aspirants under the CFA program, for instance, must garner contributions totaling at least $5,000 from at least 75 donors to qualify for the ballot. And gubernatorial candidates participating in Maine's public campaign financing system must receive threshold donations from at least 3,200 voters. Second, an emphasis on small donations appears to incentivize engagement in civic affairs and politics. When large donors were sidelined by Albuquerque's innovative program of limited donations in the 1970s, citizen participation in civic affairs rose. Analyses of the CFA by the Brennan Center and by political scientists Michael Malbin, Peter Brousseau, and Brendan Glavin in 2012 found similar results. They concluded that permitting only small donations forces candidates to solicit an entirely novel and vastly more representative set of donors. Most other wealthy democracies consider small donations so important to competitive elections that they subsidize them with tax credits and by offering matching funds. In Canada, contributors receive a 75% tax credit for the first $400 Canadian dollars of a political donation, the credit diminishing at higher amounts. And under CFA, any donation up to $175 is matched 6-1 from public coffers, making a small donation of that amount actually worth $1,225 to the recipient candidate. There have been campaign spending reform proposals introduced in Congress that feature such incentives as well. The Fair Elections Now Act, for instance, first introduced in 2009, caps political contributions but encourages small donations with a 5-1 match for the first $100 of donations. More recently, the Government by the People Act, sponsored by Congressman John Sarbanes, provides both a tax credit, $25, and a 6-1 match to encourage small donations. Limit independent political spending. In 2012, California public health advocates placed a referendum on ballots in El Monte and Richmond to impose a tax on sugary drinks in an effort to reduce consumption, a proven technique to reduce demand. As is sometimes the case in referendums like this, voters were subjected to a barrage of issue advocacy advertising by affected enterprises. Opponents commanded far more resources. The $114,000 mustered by health advocates was swamped by $4 million spent on broadcast and cable TV ads, canvassing teams, phone banks, billboards, public rallies, and the like by the sugar industry. Each anti-tax vote actually cast on Election Day cost the sugar advocates $115, but it was money well spent. The tax was defeated. Indeed, American commercial interests of every stripe in recent decades have refined a sophisticated expertise to sway voters on policy issues with lavish, independent expenditures. To reduce the risk of such manipulation, higher quality democracies limit or ban donations and public issue advocacy by independent interests for some months preceding elections. Many utilize a definition of such spending similar to that adopted by Elections Canada, as noted in Chapter 10. And if adopted in the United States, that definition should also feature the quaint standard proposed by Senator Barry Goldwater in The Conscience of a Conservative in 1960. Advocates sponsoring political appeals must be able to breathe. Recall that in Canada, nationwide political advertising and issue advocacy by independent entities during the federal election period is capped at $155,000. proportionately higher for campaigns longer than 37 days. Donors must be identified in all advertising. In Britain, the limits are also modest, as noted by journalist Jacob Rowbottom, writing in the New Republic. Independent organizations can spend no more than £988,000, $1,250,000, in support of a political party in the UK in the 12 months before a general election, and no more than £500, $625, in support of an individual candidate in the month before an election. As it happens, in the 2010 UK election, very few independent organizations came close to spending anything near the national limit. The UK approach is a good model for America. Independent political spending and issue advocacy are limited during the year preceding elections. Yet public debate is vibrant, as judged by international speech advocates such as Freedom House. Accepting Goldwater's proposal, independent spending should only be permitted by human beings. As in Canada, any cash from individuals choosing to support independent efforts should be deducted from an overall national individual donation and spending cap. In such an election structure, there would be no scope for social welfare 501c3, 501c4 advocacy organizations, PACs, or super PACs, including groups such as Americans for Prosperity. Nor would there be room for special purpose slush funds created by politicians for non-election purposes, such as the entities created to deflect accountability for the Flint water contamination from Governor Rick Snyder. The logic for limits on independent entities was explained by the Canadian Supreme Court, as noted earlier. And here is an explanation by Simon Fraser University political scientist Andrew Hurd. There are two main justifications for the third-party limits. The first is to protect the spending limits on political parties and candidates. Otherwise, parallel campaigns could be conducted by groups allied to particular parties. The other is to protect individual candidates from being targeted by expensive ad campaigns, to which they could not respond because of both their own limited funds or the spending limits imposed on candidates. Adopting the UK structure would still leave considerable leeway for organizations to opine, particularly outside the year-long election window. Entities could contribute traditional branding advertising. Moreover, lobbying activities would continue. Finally, many corporate leaders are viewed as generators of wealth and employment, guaranteeing that their voices would be heard and heeded by lawmakers and their constituents. Indeed, scholars have documented that their influence can sway public opinion even in the absence of pay-to-play. Duke business professor Aaron Chatterjee and Harvard professor Michael Toffel in 2016 assessed the ability of CEOs to influence public opinion. They chose a controversial social issue for their project: whether Indiana state law should permit discrimination against homosexuals. As a precursor to their experiment, about half of their 3,400 respondents were told that Apple CEO Timothy Cook, the CEO of Indiana-based Angie's List, William Osterley, and the mayor of Indianapolis opposed any law that permitted discrimination. We found that public support for the law declined sharply and roughly equally if respondents were informed that Mr. Cook, Mr. Osterley, or the mayor of Indianapolis were concerned about it. Prominent chief executives can shape public opinion about controversial social issues. Voter equality is maximized by election systems abroad because of effective and timely monitoring of donors and of electioneering spending, which facilitates the prosecution of political corruption. Independent third parties are also closely monitored abroad and must register immediately upon establishment. A revamped, expanded Independent Federal Election Commission, or any successor in the United States, ideally should be able to track outlays and to obtain the names and amounts of individual donations and of spending on a real-time basis. Both Elections Canada and the California Fair Political Practices Commission provide useful models. Regulators in the latter were responsible for peeling away four layers of obfuscating 501c4 cutouts in 2012, for instance, to discover that the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson and Charles Schwab, were behind an $11 million campaign of attack ads to kill Proposition 30 in that state. The proposition, raising state income taxes on higher incomes to fund a $6 billion increase in education spending, was approved by voters nonetheless. A useful reform was instituted in reaction to this exposé. California, in 2014, enacted a law requiring groups with political spending of $50,000 or more in 1 year, or $100,000 within 4 years, to reveal every donor of more than $1,000. An additional monitoring tactic is the use of undercover investigations by authorities to ferret out corrupt public officials. Such stings have been utilized to snare corrupt American and European parliamentarians. For instance, over 100 of 480 Romanian legislators responded to a fake bribe attempt by sham firms in the United Arab Emirates in a sting engineered by the daily Romania Libera. Finally, monitoring systems need to be dynamic in order to keep pace with advances in voter-influencing technology. The fittest 50 mostly fund traditional political techniques, advertising, grassroots mobilization, and the like, that should be subject to reports and auditing. But pioneers such as billionaire Robert Mercer are marrying big data from social media to target voters utilizing psychological warfare techniques derived from the military. It's called psychometrics and targets individual voters in gargantuan numbers more effectively than traditional media. Mercer has spent at least $15 million refining such tools using social data analytics to pinpoint individual swing or persuadable voters. A test run in early 2016 targeted 600,000 identified persuadables in Britain, who were soon deluged with pro-Brexit information. Similar influencer programs were likely conducted by the Koch data mining firm i360 and the Trump campaign, in collaboration with Mercer's Cambridge Analytica, using AdBuy on Twitter and Facebook during 2016. Such psychographic practices manipulate rather than persuade voters. Their use for political purposes should be prohibited, whether conducted by Russians or Americans. Limit length of campaigns. Other wealthy democracies limit the period for campaigns, and so should the United States. Campaign seasons are set by law, or in some instances, as in Canada, by common practice. The longest are nearly 5 months, 139 days, in the United Kingdom, and Mexico, 147 days, but are shorter elsewhere. Compare that to the 2016 U.S. election cycle, which began well before the first primaries on February 1, 2016. A relatively short campaign season would be welcomed by Americans. In most, if not all, other wealthy democracies, electioneering spending by candidates and political parties are prohibited except during the campaign season. Limits on third-party political spending and issue advocacy are imposed for even longer periods preceding Election Day, including the noted UK caps on independent political spending and political issue advocacy applicable for the year concluding on Election Day. Limit political and issue advertising in broadcast and other media. Peer nations have concluded that limits on broadcast advertising are an important element to controlling electioneering spending and ensuring that a factual, informative political discourse occurs between candidates, parties, and voters. Paid political advertisements on TV, but not on social media, are banned in Belgium, Britain, Brazil, France, Ireland, Japan, and others, although some airtime is variously provided free. In France, for instance, 6 hours of airtime is provided gratis, split among all presidential candidates equally. In Canada, some 214 minutes of political airtime is provided free on public television, split between parties. And private broadcasters must make available for sale at relatively low rates an additional 6.5 hours, split between parties. Political parties can purchase this additional airtime as long as they remain beneath their overall nationwide electioneering spending cap. Advertising on American TV stations is prohibited. Political parties in Germany are given modest airtime on public networks and can purchase a bit more on private networks. But as noted earlier, spending limits nonetheless held the number of times political ads by Chancellor Merkel were aired in 2013 to 140 in total. In addition, TV advertising by independent entities or associations, if permitted at all, is capped at quite low levels during the campaign season everywhere. American political advertising should be limited, with airtime ideally provided gratis and in equal portions on public television and by broadcasters enjoying use of the public airways. Such spending caps would doubtless be welcomed by viewers. The Wesleyan Media Project determined that 1.35 million ads were aired during the 2014 midterm elections in the United States. If each was 30 seconds in duration, that translates to 11,000 hours of political advertising, vastly more than permitted in peer nations. A major benefit of capping broadcast airtime abroad is a flight to positive campaigning by candidates and parties. That characteristic is magnified further if anonymity is stripped away, with actual donors identified in all independent political spending. And regulations abroad are sufficiently robust that public monitors reject outright fabrications, analogous to the U.S. Swift Boat ads regarding John Kerry in 2004, or ads during the 2012 Republican primary in South Carolina alleging that Mitt Romney was a serial killer. Political speech on social media is discussed in Chapter 15. Mandate public funding of elections. In crafting a replacement for pay-to-play in financing elections, American courts or lawmakers can draw on the rich and successful domestic history of publicly funded elections, time-tested at every level of U.S. politics. The concept was first introduced by Theodore Roosevelt in the wake of the 1907 financial panic to weaken the political influence of the fittest 50 of his day. But implementation was fitful until the Watergate scandal in 1974. The first nationwide American public funding mechanism was adopted as one element of the new campaign finance reforms enacted then by Congress. The law mandated that presidential candidates utilize only public funding for campaigns. That mandate was removed 2 years later in the Buckley ruling, leaving participation voluntary ever since. Even so, public funding comprised the bulk of presidential campaign spending until 1996, when surpassed by independent expenditures and PAC spending. All major party presidential candidates utilized public funding until 2008, when President Obama opted to fund his campaign entirely with private donations. Albuquerque adopted public funding in 1974, with other adventuresome states and localities following, supported by advocates from both political parties. The political benefits have also been bipartisan. For example, the election of grassroots conservatives in Arizona, who later emerged as the foundation of the Tea Party, was enabled by that state's public financing program. And earlier, Ronald Reagan became president thanks to public campaign financing. Challenging President Gerald Ford for the GOP nomination in 1976, Reagan ran out of money during the primaries. Accepting taxpayer funds from the newly established Presidential Public Financing Program enabled him to campaign expansively in primary states in 1976. His charisma and impressive political skills emerged and were powerful elements in his success 4 years later. Despite this history, contemporary conservatives seem unhappily surprised by the popularity of public campaign funding, with Washington Post neoconservative David Ignatius writing, "The public funding idea isn't as unpopular as you might think. In fact, grassroots staunch conservatives find it attractive as one step toward shrinking the influence of political elites. The public funding program in Tallahassee, installed by 67% of referendum voters in 2014, for instance, was a joint effort of the local Tea Party and progressive grassroots." Surveys confirm the broad base of support for public campaign financing. For example, Some 74% of respondents to the Corporate Reform Coalition survey in 2012, noted in Chapter 5, favor a campaign finance system featuring small-dollar private donations supplemented with public funding. Some 72% believed that politics would improve with public funding of congressional campaigns instead of special interest spending. Support for public funding also emerged in a detailed survey of reform ideas in 2009, conducted by political scientists at the University of Texas. On a scale of 1, no support, to 10, strongly support. Support was strongest for reforms that provided free and equal TV airtime to candidates, mean score 7.23, that strengthened the Federal Election Commission, 6.69, that shortened campaigns to 4 weeks, 6.00, and that replaced all private political contributions with public funding, 5.83. Mandate public funding of judicial elections. Hefty majorities of Americans also prefer eliminating contributions and independent political issue advertising in judicial elections, and judges themselves have long agreed. Surveys by the nonpartisan National Center for State Courts, beginning in 2001, found public funding of such elections were favored by 53% of judges surveyed in California, 2001, 56% in Florida, 2001, 69% in Illinois, 2001, 74% in New York, 2001, 60% of voters in Idaho, 2002, and 65% of voters in Wisconsin, 2008. The legal profession also supports public funding, exemplified by this declaration by an American Bar Association commission in 2002. The commission unanimously recommends that states that elect judges in contested elections finance judicial elections with public funds. The commission concludes that public financing of judicial elections will address the perceived impropriety associated with judicial candidates accepting private contributions from individuals and organizations interested in the outcomes of cases those candidates may later decide as judges. In addition, recall that Jerry Palast evaluated survey data garnered anonymously from 2,428 judges serving on state Supreme Courts, appellate courts, and lower courts on behalf of justice at stake. Most respondents were subject to election and thus had firsthand experience with the range of pathologies in state courts induced by pay-to-play. The survey revealed considerable angst regarding the influence of money, with 71% of the judges believing that campaign donations to judicial candidates should be limited. Some 61% supported a publicly financed campaign system for judicial elections. In the interim, until such reforms occur, a majority of respondents, 56%, agreed that judges should recuse from cases involving campaign contributors. As noted earlier, that is an impractical solution. American experience with public funding. The broad appeal of programs for public funding of political or judicial campaigns is responsible for their spread in various forms to some 25 states since the 1970s, including 13 statewide programs in various formulations. Aside from New York City, established in 1988, the most expansive are elaborate statewide programs in Maine, 1996, Arizona, 1998, and Connecticut, 2005. These are clean election programs where full funding for campaigns is provided once a candidate qualifies by raising numerous small donations. 10 other states provide campaign funding to match small donations. A few states, like Maryland, provide public funding just to gubernatorial and judicial candidates. Public funding programs have also been adopted in various forms by a host of localities beyond Albuquerque and New York City, including Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Long Beach, Los Angeles, Santa Fe, San Francisco, Seattle, and most recently in Chicago, Howard and Montgomery counties in Maryland, and Tallahassee. California, in 2016, lifted its 29-year-old ban that will enable public financing to be broadly adopted beyond the few current city programs. In contrast, programs have been pared back or dropped in recent years in Wisconsin and North Carolina. The repeal by North Carolina Republicans included terminating the public funding of judicial elections also. Public funding is popular with Americans. When the decision is left to voters rather than politicians, public funding generally is approved. For instance, voters in Maine in 2015 rejected GOP efforts to end the state program, instead voting to considerably expand funding. Under Buckley-era rulings, participation by aspirants in these programs must be voluntary. Candidates are given the option to participate by accepting some public funding or to opt out and rely instead on private contributions. All programs require participating candidates, but not those opting out, to accept electioneering spending limits. It is also common for candidates to be required to qualify for public support by raising a sizable number of small donations, as already noted. Participants are usually required to engage in debates with rivals. In Seattle, for instance, the minimum is 3 debates. Program revenues are typically derived from civil and other fines, such as speeding tickets, or from general revenue. Seattle voters in November 2015 approved an innovative and user-friendly public campaign financing program that began in 2017. Financed by a token increase in local real estate taxes, i.e. $9, each registered voter receives 4 $25 democracy vouchers during each election cycle to donate to as many as 4 candidates in city elections. Expanding that program statewide, however, was rejected by voters in 2016. Public funding programs succeed in drawing participation from well more than one half of all candidates. Some 74% of winning Maine state Senate candidates in 2016 were clean election candidates. For instance, overall, 64% of winning state legislators in 2016 were clean election candidates, up from 58% in the previous legislature. In Connecticut in 2014, both gubernatorial candidates participated, as did all 6 winning candidates for statewide office and 83.4% of winning state legislators. And some 196 candidates of both parties participated in 2016. Receiving a total of $8 million. To receive $95,710, Senate candidates had to qualify by raising $15,000 from at least 300 constituents. House candidates received $28,150 upon raising $5,000 from at least 150 district residents. The outcome has been a more diverse group of competitive candidates and legislators, including more women and members of minority groups. For instance, 89%, 51 out of 57, of the women elected in Connecticut in 2014 were public funding candidates. As University of Illinois professor Michael Miller noted in a detailed 2014 analysis, when publicly funded candidates are freed of most fundraising chores, they spend more time interacting with voters and refining electoral skills than do traditionally funded candidates. Consequently, incumbents face more and higher quality competitors. Recall that no mayoral incumbents were re-elected during the 2 decades of public campaign funding in Albuquerque. A study by Kenneth R. Mayer, Timothy Werner, and Amanda Williams summarized the academic perspective on such programs this way. Public funding programs increase the pool of candidates willing and able to run for state legislative office. This effect is most pronounced for challengers, who were far more likely than incumbents to accept public funding. Public funding increases the likelihood that an incumbent will have a competitive race. Public funding has not made incumbents safer. Fears that public funding would amount to an Incumbency Protection Act are unfounded. In the end, we conclude that public funding programs, particularly the full clean elections systems in Arizona and Maine, increase the competitiveness of state legislative elections. Public funding also focuses candidates on middle-class concerns, as explained by George Leventhal, a local elected official in Montgomery County, Maryland. When you are looking for campaign support in chunks of $1,000 or more, you spend a lot of time with millionaires. What I'm finding now is that to get to $500, donor threshold, I've spent most of my time with ordinary working people. Public campaign funding programs in this country and others have successfully relied on small donors to provide adequate resources for more competitive elections. They have also proven that small donors, combined with some public funding, can replace large donors in sufficiently financing electoral systems. The most comprehensive analysis of small donors is by Public Campaign, an advocacy group supporting public funding of campaigns. It found that small donors of $200 or less gave a total of $1 billion during the 2014 election cycle. Real-world experience in Canada, Britain, and numerous American localities such as Albuquerque, Connecticut, and Maine are evidence that public campaign finance systems and spending caps ensure informative, robust, and competitive elections, and make incumbents nervous. A partisan divide created by the fittest 50. Participation by candidates has been robust and bipartisan since the inception of public campaign funding, and remains so today. Some 78% of winning Republicans in Connecticut in 2014, for instance, utilized public funding. Indeed, Tea Party activists and state local GOP officials were co-chairs of the successful ballot referendum in 2016 that established the South Dakota Campaign Finance Voucher Program, featuring an independent ethics board and a $100 limit on lobbyists' gifts. Opponents included the Koch brothers, who funded 95% of spending on the losing side. The Kochs don't take defeats easily, however. More anxious to please the Kochs by preserving pay-to-play than their constituents, Republican state legislators and the governor in South Dakota defiantly repealed the reforms on February 2, 2017. Such defiance is rare. The other recent episode was when GOP lawmakers in 2017 gutted implementation of an anti-gerrymandering constitutional amendment supported by 63% of Florida voters. The reaction of these South Dakota politicians dramatizes the opposition among Republican officials, but not grassroots, to public campaign financing programs. Recall that such programs have recently been terminated by GOP state officials in North Carolina and Wisconsin. In Congress, the GOP majority on the Administration Committee in the House of Representatives in early 2015 voted to entirely extinguish the presidential public financing program. And the Trump administration may support its demise. Even so, political scientists such as Michael Miller have found empirically that public funding does not disadvantage conservatives or Republicans. Republican distaste for public funding appears rooted in three factors: their small government ideology, their possible superior ability to garner private donations, and their allegiance to the fittest 50. Who naturally have an extreme antipathy toward contribution limits and public funding. Thus, GOP candidates make somewhat less use of public funding opportunities than Democrats. For instance, the share of Republican candidates for state house seats in Arizona, Connecticut, 2008 only, and Maine utilizing public funding ranged between 40% and 66% from 2002 to 2008. The share of Democrats in those states varied between 70% and 85%. Public campaign funding advocates have also had to overcome opposition rooted in the jurisprudence of the Roberts Republicans, whose rulings have notably diminished the lure of such programs. In Randall v. Sorrell, 2006, for example, they rejected mandatory electioneering spending caps and donations limits imposed on participating candidates in state and local public campaign funding programs. And in 2011, Arizona Free Enterprise v. Bennett and McComish v. Bennett, they rejected provisions allowing participating candidates to receive a large infusion of taxpayer funds to match lavish electioneering spending by a non-participating, privately funded rival. Such a provision had enabled Janet Napolitano to defeat a well-funded congressman in 2006 in Arizona, becoming the first governor elected with public funding. These rulings reduced participation in some public funding programs. In Maine, for instance, candidate participation in 2016 fell below its peak of 81% in 2008. In Arizona, the share of general election candidates participating fell by more than half, 66% to 28%, between 2008 and 2014. Indeed, in the Arizona election of 2012, 18 legislators who had previously been elected using public funding switched to relying solely on private donations. These steps to roll back public funding programs by Republicans have met resistance. Unhappy voters in Maine reacted to the Arizona Free Enterprise ruling by approving a referendum in November 2015, increasing the amount of money available to publicly funded candidates. The referendum mandated other improvements as well, and requires disclosure on political advertisements of the top three donors to each candidate not participating in public funding. The events in Maine are indicative of persistently broad support for public campaign funding programs, despite the hostility of Roberts Republicans. Connecticut's statewide program and the CFA program in New York City are especially thriving. In 2013, New York City's program saw a 92% participation rate by candidates during the primary and 72% during the general election. The next year, participation in Connecticut was a record 84% of winning candidates. This enthusiasm is also reflected in successful 2016 referenda designed to improve the quality of American democracy. They included: South Dakota voters established a program to encourage small donations, providing each voter $100 in vouchers to donate to eligible candidates in future elections. This is the aforementioned program subsequently killed by GOP legislators and governors in February 2017. Missouri voters reestablished campaign donation limits that had been removed in 2008 by state legislators. In the future, individual donations to candidates are capped at $2,600 and at $25,000 to political parties. Programs to provide a public match for small donations were approved in Berkeley, California, and Howard County, Maryland. Voters in California, Washington, and Wisconsin approved resolutions to overturn the Roberts Republicans' Citizens United ruling. Rehabilitate the electoral system. The Buckley genre's embrace of pay-to-play is responsible for the income bias identified by Giles, Page, and other scholars. This chapter has outlined the specific steps that higher-quality democracies utilize to remediate that bias. They do more by also utilizing superior electoral systems to enhance voter equality and sovereignty. These systems provide a model for America to upgrade its own system, a system judged to be of dismal quality by international experts. The most compelling and substantive international analysis of the quality of electoral systems is produced by the Election Integrity Project, EIP, a joint effort of 2,000 political scientists and other independent observers across the globe under the auspices of the Australian Research Council, the University of Sydney, and Harvard University. Its most recent survey analyzed 213 elections conducted by 153 nations between 2012 and 2016. Experts evaluated practices in each nation against a global standard of 49 components measuring the quality of elections, assessing how well individual political rights and voter preferences were safeguarded and reflected in electoral outcomes. The EIP experts found American elections to be of poor and deteriorating quality, judged using impartial global criteria. In two of the last five presidential elections, for instance, also-ran aspirants were jumped over the winning candidates, once, in 2000, by court decree. American elections are risky enterprises where outcomes may be determined by the legal wisdom of the courts rather than a count of the votes cast in the ballot box. The evidence shows that recent U.S. elections display the worst performance among 24 Western democracies. The evidence does not suggest that the quality of American elections has improved over these successive contests. If anything, problems are perceived to have worsened. The nonpartisan EIP experts were particularly critical of the role played by wealthy donors and of the extraordinary ability of partisans in Congress and state legislatures to establish and police self-serving electoral rules governing their own career prospects. Matters of electoral governance should not be determined through laws enacted by self-interested partisan representatives in state houses, the equivalent to putting the fox in charge of the chicken coop. EIP found the quality of American elections to be so low that it ranked only 52nd in electoral integrity among the 153 nations, well behind other wealthy democracies, and also below the caliber of elections in a large number of middle-income nations, such as Croatia, Tunisia, and Brazil. Indeed, the poor quality of American elections was determined to be no better than those conducted by a group of other underperforming democracies, including Rwanda, Barbados, Panama, and South Africa. See chart 12.1. You heard that correctly. A separate study released in January 2017 by The Economist, summarized in an epigraph to this chapter, reached similar findings, the magazine's editors concluding that the United States is a flawed democracy. Popular trust in government, elected representatives, and political parties has fallen to extremely low levels in the U.S. The U.S. now keeps company with countries that include Italy, Botswana, Sri Lanka, and Mexico. Other foreign experts concur. American elections are characterized by partisan voter suppression, tens of millions of wasted votes, maladministration, and a host of ensuing second-order malpractices. As noted by Australian Professor Pippa Norris, U.S. elections are exemplified by inaccurate voter registers, partisan gerrymandering, maladministration of polling, vote buying, clientelistic politics, erroneous counts, campaigns awash with money, and excessively high legal barriers to elected office. Second-order malpractices can happen anywhere, as exemplified by the notorious Hanging Chads in Florida in 2000. The EIP assessment lamented the massive influence of wealthy private donors on electoral campaigns and programs. It fingered the following specific practices as responsible for the low quality of American elections: winner-take-all electoral systems and single-member districts that misrepresent voter preferences and produce tens of millions of wasted votes cast for losing candidates, a phenomenon rare in wealthy democracies. The remedy is adoption of proportional representation, PR, systems to ensure that each voter's preference is reflected in composition of legislatures. Conceived in Denmark during the 1850s, PR's leading proponents include Alexis de Tocqueville in France and John Stuart Mill in England. Utilized in over 20 higher-quality democracies in Europe such as Germany, PR eliminates gerrymandering and wasted votes. But in the United States, political party officials have successfully resisted efforts to install PR and have eliminated those established by voter referendum in cities such as Cincinnati. Today, it attracts little attention, aside from advocates such as Democratic Congressman Don Beyer and the nonpartisan advocacy organization Fair Vote. A different, narrower definition of wasted votes is utilized by American political scientists. It is a measure of the degree to which partisan lawmakers create gerrymandered legislative districts that are lopsided in favor of one political party. Gerrymandering of legislative districts to favor the ruling party. The success of U.S. political parties in cornering state governments and congressional seats, regardless of popular vote outcomes, is a consequence of gerrymandering. The dark corners of American democracy are gerrymandered, single-party legislative districts fostering lawmakers on the political fringe. Gerrymandering is only possible in the rare winner-take-all single-member legislative district structures like the United States, not in the PR electoral systems nearly universal in higher-quality democracies. Until PR is adopted, an interim reform is to rely on entities independent of politicians to draw legislative district lines. Of the 43 states with more than one seat in Congress, 8, including California, no longer permit lawmakers themselves to design their legislative districts. Instead, they rely on independent commissions, most installed by citizen referenda. And one state, Democratic-leaning Maryland, has proposed that 5 other mid-Atlantic states, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and North Carolina, join it in establishing such nonpartisan commissions. The imaginative proposal was vetoed by the Republican governor in 2017. Importantly, the Supreme Court in Arizona State Legislature versus Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission, 2015, ruled such independent entities constitutional. Winner-take-all elections and single-member districts cause electoral outcomes in the most gerrymandered American state, North Carolina, to reflect popular choices and voter opinion no better than do elections in notoriously faux democracies such as Cuba, Indonesia, or Sierra Leone. Extremely low turnout for congressional and other down-ballot offices. Negative political advertising, indifference by legislators to popular sentiment, and the oppressive influence of wealthy donors has discouraged participation. Moreover, with major elections held on Tuesdays, many Americans must leave work to vote. Low turnout is exacerbated by partisan steps limiting early voting opportunities and reducing the availability of ballot stations in states controlled by the Republican Party, such as Ohio. Partisan disenfranchisement through targeted voter registration restrictions. The EIP analysts noted that the burdensome American voter registration system de facto discriminates against lower classes and African Americans in particular. Partisans should not be involved in voter registration or balloting mechanisms. The success of American Republican officials in restricting registration opportunities reflects the absence of a federalized, automated national voter registration system. Restrictive practices include needless voter ID requirements, limited election day registration opportunities, the curtailing of registration campaigns by nonpartisan groups, such as the League of Women Voters, and the unwarranted purge of voter registration rolls, e.g., in Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, and Wisconsin, particularly targeting minorities. In higher quality democracies, voter systems register citizens at age 18 and autonomously update them during their lives. These practices have been justified by members of the Republican Party with bogus assertions, including Trump advisor Stephen Miller, who has mendaciously asserted that 14% of non-citizens, including Latino immigrants, are registered to vote. The Electoral College and absence of a binary runoff mechanism allows electoral losers to ascend to the presidency. America stands alone among wealthy democracies in thwarting the majoritarian will of voters in selecting national leaders. Other nations select national leaders by absolute majority vote, France, or by parliamentary vote, Germany. As Swiss researcher Nils Christian Bormann and Penn State political science professor Matt Golder explain, the concept of an electoral college is concurrently used only in the United States, after Argentina and Finland abandoned it in the 1980s. Reforms threatened by institutionalized voter suppression. The institutionalized disenfranchisement and suppression of political opponents pinpointed by the EIP is rooted in 2 judicial rulings by the Roberts Republicans. As noted in Chapter 5, Crawford empowered voter ID laws, while Shelby declared Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional. Shelby restored the Jim Crow-era doctrine of undue state sovereignty on voter eligibility. Federal authority subservient, belying the 15th Amendment. In the wake of that ruling, Numerous Republican state governments enacted voter suppression laws aimed at Democratic-leaning voters. Some 600,000, mostly poor or elderly whites and minorities in Texas alone, who lacked required IDs, were stripped of eligibility. The types of suppression highlighted by the EIP report include burdensome new voter ID rules, elimination of hundreds of polling stations in Democratic precincts, elimination of voter registration drives in high schools and on college campuses, purges of eligible voters from registration rolls, reduction in early voting opportunities, and ending Election Day registration. For instance, GOP election officials since 2008 in Indiana have manipulated the early voting process to expand Republican voting opportunities while shrinking Democratic ones. They tripled the number of locations in Republican-leaning counties like Hamilton to facilitate voters with transportation or schedule challenges while restricting Democratic-heavy Indianapolis, Marion County, to just one site. Consequently, each early voting site serves roughly 100,000 registered voters in Hamilton, but more than 700,000 in Marion. The strategy was quite effective. Compared to 2008, early voting rose by 21,000, 63%, in Hamilton in 2016, while actually shrinking by 24,000, 26%, in Marion. The share of all ballots cast early rose from 25% to 34% in Hamilton County, while declining to 19% from 24% in Marion County. Abolishing the ability of citizens to register on Election Day is a particularly effective vote suppression tactic. The 15 states permitting such registration consistently have the nation's highest electoral turnout rates, including the top state of Minnesota, where 75% of eligible registered and unregistered citizens cast ballots in 2016, 25% greater than the national average of 60% in presidential election cycles. With the share of non-white eligible voters rising briskly nationally, institutionalized suppression has emerged as an imperative for the Republican Party, fully supported by the Trump administration. Its Justice Department, in January 2017, for instance, reversed long-standing practice by ceasing all investigations of alleged violations by state and local GOP officials of the Voting Rights Act. A few months later, it conjured a Presidential Advisory Commission on Electoral Integrity, stacked with GOP officials experienced in stripping Democratic-leaning citizens from state voter rolls. In-person voter fraud in America is essentially non-existent, a sham. Yet the goal of the commission is to sow doubts about that fact in order to justify the widespread disenfranchisement of voters who bend Democratic. The commission is chaired by Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach, whose cross-check initiative in the past has widely disseminated bogus registration information used to purge voters in states like Idaho and Iowa. For instance, it fingered 240,000 Iowans in 2012 and 2014 as purge targets because they shared with out-of-state voters common birth dates and first and last names, like Maria Rodriguez. Yet researchers at Stanford, Harvard, the University of Pennsylvania, and Microsoft determined that only a minuscule 6 of them had cast double ballots. The Trump administration has also refused to intervene in Ohio, where GOP Governor John Kasich has purged 2 million mostly young, poor, and non-white occasional voters since 2011. The purges have affected Democratic-leaning neighborhoods at roughly twice the rate of Republican-leaning neighborhoods, according to an independent analysis by Reuters. Looking ahead, the Trump administration, Roberts Republicans, and the GOP Congress may prohibit online voter registration, which significantly eases the chore of registration. Some 31 states allowed online registration in 2016, a dramatic increase since 2010 when only 6 did. There are 3 other electoral reforms expanding voting that may also be targeted. The first could be repeal of the National Voter Registration Act, also known as Motor Voter. This law facilitates voter registration for citizens interacting with state agencies. Indeed, some 10 states and the District of Columbia have or are installing automatic registration mechanisms for such citizens, including Oregon. Under its first-in-the-nation law, citizens interacting with that state's Division of Motor Vehicles are automatically registered to vote. Some 272,000 were registered in its first year. Easing the burden of registration paid off in November 2016, when participation by these new voters caused the increase in turnout in Oregon to lead the nation. A second target could be reforms that ensure binary runoffs occur, like the Louisiana electoral system, a variation that prevents a second election when no candidate wins a majority initially is called ranked choice, in use in a few localities such as Tacoma Park, Maryland. Residents cast votes for candidates in hierarchical order, ensuring that only candidates favored by a majority of voters can be elected. Third could be a ban on nonpartisan or open primaries. All aspirants for a political office in California, Washington State, and Louisiana are required to first compete in a single primary, the so-called jungle primary, regardless of political party affiliation. The two aspirants receiving the most votes subsequently compete in a binary runoff in the November general election. This system has quite dramatically moderated the voting behavior of congressional Republicans in California. They have been forced, since 2012, out of the dark corners of American democracy to compete in primaries not dominated by staunchly conservative party grassroots. Importantly, California also eliminated gerrymandered legislative districts at the same time. In 2013, for instance, the median left-right congressional voting record of California Republicans shifted from the quite conservative 85th percentile among all members of Congress to the 60th percentile. Ending pay-to-play would ease the path for legislators to then pursue the reforms explored in this chapter. It would enable members of Congress so inclined to meet the preferences of middle-class voters rather than donors, raising the quality of American democracy, diminishing the income bias, and affirming original intent. Another important pillar of democracy identified by the framers was the quality of information available to voters. This original intent, derailed by the fake news phenomenon during the 2016 presidential election, is examined in the following chapters.